Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 1:37, and that's Pacific Summer Time. Well, today being Friday, May 29th, it's also the last Friday of the month, so this is the big picture long-term audio for the various different asset classes. But let's kick off and review the month. In Asia, the majority of indices were in a process of mean reversion. Both the Philippines and Australia bounced from the region of their respective 200-day moving averages in here today. This month also saw the Nikkei push through the 20,000 level. That's important for Japan, not least because this month also saw the yen breaking down against the US dollar and resuming its medium-term downtrend. This month also saw the Chinese stock market break up out of its most recent range, extend its advance, and then yesterday we had this really outsized downside key day reversal. It bounced off the lows in here today to suggest that it's not going to fall like that on consecutive days, but we can anticipate that there is going to be additional volatility in the Chinese market over the next 2 weeks, for the simple reason that everyone is looking to MSCI's decision on whether to admit the A-share index in there. That could be a potentially very big thing for China. Probably a lot of that is already in the price. So in the event that they do not admit the A-shares to the emerging markets index, well then that could result in a lengthier process of mean reversion. So that is, I'd say, part of the reason that some of the people are taking their money off the table. When you think about China over the medium term, well, we're in an interest rate environment where we can anticipate that monetary policy is going to remain progressively more accommodative, that China is engaging in quantitative easing, or at least its own version of that, and that is one of the reasons that you've had this outsized move in the market over the last 3 months. Also, they're moving progressively closer to expanding the Hong Kong-Shanghai Connect program, initiating a Shenzhen-Hong Kong Connect program, and loosening the bans so that there will be a greater flow of capital, particularly into China. What that suggests is that we're probably in a process of mean reversion at the present time, but that it's unlikely to be the end of what has so far at the very early stages of what could be a very big bull market. What is interesting is that people are talking about a bubble. Well, 6 months ago they were talking about a depression. Now they're talking about a bubble. Generally speaking, that means that people don't have a position. Nobody talks about a bubble when they are overweight in something. It generally means that people are underweight and they're waiting for a pullback, or they're hoping for a pullback before initiating a position. India is also in this process of mean reversion. The mean reversion is certainly would be the theme for the month, I think. What we've seen in India was that it was perhaps one of the best performing markets last year, and that this year has turned into a process of mean reversion and consolidation. And that's not wholly unexpected. You'd kind of anticipate that when something has gone up for so long that it has to at least consolidate part of the advance. Well, that's exactly what we're getting. The rupee has been also one of the firmest currencies in the region. I guess a constant topic within the long-term audios that we've had over the last year has been that currency market volatility wasn't something we really had to worry about all that much in the decade from about 2002-2003 onwards, because the dollar was in a medium-term downtrend against a whole basket of currencies. Well, what it meant was that from the perspective of a foreign investor, you could invest in places like Asia or Latin America, get currency market, capital market, and yield, and all of those would be appreciating at the same time. Well, that's over. You're just not getting that anymore because the dollar is strengthening, and it's not just strengthening against the euro. It's strengthening against a whole basket of currencies. This is an incredibly broad-based rally. There is no country wants a strong currency, but some countries are willing to tolerate a weaker currency. Some countries are willing to tolerate a strong currency for a while, but other countries need a weak currency. Well, at the moment, Europe needs a weak currency. Japan needs a weak currency. The Chinese are allowing their monetary policy to ease. They're attempting to transition. We're not yet at a position where they need a weaker currency. What the IMF said this week was that the renminbi is no longer overvalued, that they think it's fair value. That's what the chart tells us as well, that the devaluation from 1993-94 has been completely unwound, that the 6 yuan to the dollar level is probably a hard level, that Beijing doesn't want to see it strengthen beyond 6, and that the door is open, that if they need to devalue the currency, that they potentially could do that. They're going to avoid that as much as possible. They have just begun to internationalize the currency. They want to create an air of the confidence around the value of the currency. At least part of the reason that they have been accumulating such large quantities of gold has been to help to bolster the view that the renminbi is a firm currency. So they're not going to devalue the renminbi willy-nilly, but it is a potential outcome that is open to them in the event that the reorganization of the economy that they're currently engaged in doesn't go according to plan. At the moment, there isn't really any evidence that it is not going exactly according to plan. When we go and look at Europe, then the devaluation of the euro has resulted in a lockstep move an inverse correlation between the euro and the stock markets. And that saw really quite impressive rallies right across the European indices in the early part of this year. Well, the inverse correlation has broken down somewhat over the last 3 weeks. And part of the reason for that is because of this continued stress around Greece. Well, everybody knew back in 2003 that Greece had lied to get into the euro, that they had falsified their economic figures in order to gain access. That was really an indication that Greece viewed the European Union as a donor rather than as a partner. And they're still in this really very difficult process of reassessing their engagement with Europe. Well, Europe is a very collegial place. Once you're in, they don't want you to leave, and that's very much baked into the bureaucracy. They're not going to kick Greece out, but what they do want is an acceptance that the profligacy that the administrations and repeat administrations engaged in there is over, and that, you know, Greece is going to grow up in terms of its governance. Well, it might be a bridge too far. We just don't know yet. Perhaps the most likely scenario is that this is going to represent just another papering over of the issues that remain outstanding, and that we'll move forward for another few months before we rehash all of the same arguments over again. Well, if that's the base case, there is an element of the boy who cried wolf to all of this, in that we have been scared and nothing happens, and scared and nothing happens. And the market at the present time, you look at the Greek stock market, it's down over 90% from its high. But it's holding above the 500 level. It's actually almost 50% above that level. And really right now in the region of the 200-day moving average, that the panic is over, that the real panic was a couple of years ago, and now we're in a process of consolidation. That when you look at Greek government bond yields, that you continue to have this medium-term trend where yields have been expanding. But we haven't accelerated higher over the last couple of weeks. In fact, what you've seen is that the yield has compressed. It suggests that both the bond markets and the stock market are concluding that this is going to be just another rehash of the same arguments, and that come the end of next week, we'll be in a position where Greece will still be in the eurozone for at least another few months. Well, it's probably not a bad time to think that we buy companies, we don't buy countries. That's not the case really with the bond market, but in the stock market it certainly is. When we look at the wider European market, then the devaluation of the currency is really a very big deal. And we can contrast it rather favorably with what's happening in Japan. That Japan, after decades of sclerosis in terms of their bureaucracy, is now engaged in outright devaluation of the currency. That if you go to the chart library and you type in the Bank of Japan, you'll see the Bank of Japan's balance sheet. And it hasn't looked back. It's just on a persistent trend of expansion for over the last 3 years. They're increasing the size of their balance sheet aggressively. That's why you're seeing the yen breaking down against the US dollar. That's why you're seeing the Nikkei starting to outperform, and not just in an inverse correlation with the yen, but also because corporate profits are improving. That this massive devaluation, regardless of the fact that Japanese companies have outsourced at least part of their manufacturing to foreign jurisdictions in order to preserve themselves from the strength of the yen, that even in that case, what we're seeing is that corporate profits are improving. Now let's go and then look at what's happening in Europe. The euro had been among the strongest currencies in the world, and part of the reason for that is because the ECB had withdrawn €1 trillion from circulation and really added fuel to the flames of deflation. That you take out €1 trillion, which was basically a third of the money supply within the context of an 18-month period, you're going to get deflation. You're going to get downward pressure on economic activity. Well, that's exactly what you had. That they were so afraid of deflation from an institutional perspective that they've had this deflationary problem. Well, that's being reversed. They're now printing currency. They're going to re-expand their balance sheet back out to €3 trillion. That's going to take another maybe 15 months. Well, we've had the inverse correlation move. We're now in a process of consolidation. That the European markets, for example, the DAX today was down approximately 2%. But that's within the context of a 1% up move in the middle of the week, a 2% down move at the beginning of the week. This is still a process of consolidation. We're still above the 200-day moving average. And there's also, of course, this additional stress because of, in the short term, because of Greece. We can have the market is concluding that there's probably not an awful lot to say about it, but that people are still worried about it. And we're not in this persistent, trending, momentum-driven move that we had at the beginning of the year. This is a process of consolidation. And I think people are probably looking at Japan and saying, well, Japan did not much of anything for a year after its explosive breakout. Well, that then means that there's no need to pay up for these European indices. That it really would be better off to wait until they pull back into the region of their trend means before advancing or before initiating long positions. Well, let's skip over the pond and look at the USA. The major indices like the Dow Jones, the S&P and the Nasdaq have been largely range bound for much of this year, and part of the reason for that is because of the removal of quantitative easing and the strength of the US dollar. Well, you can see that today's revision of GDP figures was tied to the fact that you had a very cold winter period, but also that the strength of the dollar was an inhibiting factor to corporate profits. Well, the stock market didn't really respond. You continue to see that this is very much now a stock picker's market, that there are still some shares that are breaking out. Well, CBS is a good example in here today. I've posted that chart that there is increased M&A activity, and in particularly in the biotech sector, in the technology sector, and in the cable sector. Well, I've posted articles on all three of those in here this week. Well, when you think about it, we have incredibly low interest rates. That interest rates have never been this low. In absolute terms, we're at incredibly low rates for corporate bond yields, and corporate bond spreads are still really very attractive, but in absolute terms, that corporations can borrow money for practically nothing. And so, with the anticipation that that's not always going to be the case, M&A activity is picking up, and that's generally positive for stock market investors. Weighing it all up, when the economy contracted by 0.7% last quarter, people will be looking at the Fed and saying, well, how likely are they to raise rates? What we're seeing is that wage growth is starting to improve, that wage demands are rising, that a number of cities, and it was Los Angeles late last week, have instituted, or they anticipate, raising their minimum wages to $15 an hour within the next couple of years. That would take the minimum wage up to the highest in the world. It's really an absolutely outsized move. And what it also speaks to is that people are getting progressively sicker of the fact that wages haven't really gone up in the last 3 or 4 years. And there's this very strong correlation between the level of the Fed funds rate and the growth rate in wages. Wages have gone nowhere for 3 years, and neither has the Fed funds rate. It would have to then, we could conclude that the Fed isn't going to do anything until they see wage growth breaking out. We're not there yet, but it would be a really big indicator from the Fed's perspective. And I guess the other way of thinking about it is that because they're looking at the PCE deflator in terms of their inflationary bias, that they don't count energy or food, then wage growth is one of the things that really does move the needle in terms of their inflationary bias. Perhaps the more important question, though, is when will the second interest rate hike be? That considering that they have spent all this money and all of this political capital on attempting to revive the economy and so far been moderately successful, that they're unlikely to risk that success. So regardless of whether they raise rates in September or not, then the question would be, when is their second rate hike going to be? Well, it's probably not going to be the same as what we saw after 2003. We've already had this incredibly long interval where they've done nothing. And that would suggest that when they do raise rates, that the next one will probably be a bit further out. Well, when we think then about the stock market, that we've had this loss of momentum due to the fact that quantitative easing has ended, that if we're not as close to an interest rate hike as some people might have thought a couple of months ago, then the tightening that one would associate with that is probably a bit further off as well. Well, when we think then about the consistency characteristics of this trend, that we have had this loss of momentum, but that the progression of higher reaction lows that is evident on the Dow, the NASDAQ, the S&P 500 is still very much intact, and a sustained move below the trend mean would really be required to suggest that that is really changing. When we look at the Russell 2000, it's an interesting case because it had this big drawdown in October and then rallied right back up to break out to new highs and found support in the region of the upper side of the underlying range in the last month. Well, small caps do well in a low interest rate environment. If you want to expand your business, then there's probably no better time than when funding is both abundant and cheap. And also, smaller cap companies don't generally have the international exposure that would expose them to the strengthening dollar. So they have been doing reasonably well. It's also likely to be a lead indicator considering just how much it has outperformed for future trouble in the wider market. When we think then about the Dow theory, then the transportation index has broken down this week. It's been led lower by the airline sector, having been led higher by it earlier on. There is a number of these particularly the lower fare airlines, have become really very overextended and are now in a process of mean reversion. It's not exactly the kind of sector that has been noted for investor returns over the long term, and what we could be moving into is a price war where the benefits of lower energy prices are going to get arbitraged out of this sector. But the underperformance of the transportation index is worthy of mention because it is worth watching for the simple reason that we can sort of rationalize it by thinking about the airlines, and we can also think that it might also be as a result of the weak economic data that we had in the first quarter. Well, it might be one or the other, but it's certainly something that we need to watch. And not least if we start to see other indices breaking their progression of higher reaction lows. Well, when we think then about the medium term, that the bond market, not least the long end of the bond market, has broken the progression of lower rally highs in terms of the yield, suggesting that supply dominance has been in evidence for the last few months. The 30-year went to a new all-time low in terms of the yield earlier this year on record volume. Well, generally speaking, that's not. If that was a stock market moving to a new all-time high and then pulling back on extraordinarily high volume, it would be the kind of contrarian signal that would set commentators alight all over the world. And yet nobody's really commenting on that phenomenon in the bond markets. Well, since then, we've seen that the long bonds yield has broken the progression of lower rally highs, and that this is increasingly looking like a failed downside break. We're seeing some consolidation in the region of the 200-day moving average at the present time. The extent to which it can consolidate in the region of the moving average and then break out would raise the possibility that we're going to see the long bond trade up to 4% over the next year, but that it will have to hold the majority of the advance in terms of the yield, which is obviously a decline in price. When we look at it longer term, that these are incredibly low levels, and that what we have is evidence of type 3 bottoming activity. And that is generally consistent with incredible volatility and a lengthy ranging phase. That's not really going to be the accepted theory until we see that the progression of lower rally highs is broken and that yields persist going sideways for a long time. Well, the reality is that this is a market where you're being rewarded with momentum, or at least you have been over the last 5 years. You're certainly not being rewarded with yield. If you wanted yield, you'd be buying equities, you'd be buying property, you're getting a much better return there. And then this is really a trader's market. When people aren't really buying from a yield to maturity basis, then they are held hostage by the momentum of the market. And this is not a market that is still trading on momentum. What we have seen, though, is that on the futures basis, that the long bond future has found support in the region of the 200-day moving average, and it would need to sustain a move below it to really confirm medium-term supply dominance. So we're really at an interesting level in terms of the bond markets. Well, considering that this is a 35-year bull market, that what happens here is really a big deal. It's no exaggeration to say that this really is the biggest bubble of them all. But nobody really worries about a bubble until it bursts. And we might be getting long in the tooth. This might be a market which is looking increasingly risky. But until there's evidence of that the bond market has peaked, that the people who have been buying the dips for the last 35 years are no longer making money, then that's when you get the panicky type of move. It means that when we do get the long bond yield back up towards 4%, it could then fail, just like it has failed at the long-term progression of lower rally highs over the last 30 years. Well, if it indeed does break out, well, then we can conclude that the top is in, that the bottom in yields is in, and that we're in a new secular process of yield expansion. In the context of the stock market, the progression of higher reaction lows remains in place, and we've broken out of a 13-year range for the major indices. That's a very big deal. It's largely mirrored in Europe, where the DAX has broken out of a long range and the FTSE has only just broken out of what is nearly a 15-year range. And generally speaking, when you go back and look at history, that these lengthy processes of consolidation usually give way to incredibly impressive uptrends, where when we look back over time, that the move to new highs, it might have been trumpeted at the time as the highest level that anyone has ever seen, but it looks like very small beer when you look back at the course of what has been an incredible bull market. Well, we've only broken out on the S&P over the last 18 months. The argument is really whether we're going to see a larger process of consolidation or a shorter process of consolidation. We would be giving the benefit of the doubt to the upside, provided the majority of the advance is held. Well, the upper side of the underlying range for the S&P 500 is between 1550 and 1600, and the index is currently trading at over 2000. So it might not seem particularly palatable at the present moment, but that there is the potential for a 20% drawdown, and then this bull market still look perfectly fine. We won't have evidence that something like that is unfolding unless the progression of higher reaction lows is broken. Well, at the present time, we just don't know exactly how this is going to unfold, but that we do know that bull markets that could potentially last 20 years do not go up in a straight line, and that when the progression of higher reaction lows is eventually broken, that will be presented with a better buying opportunity not long thereafter. But if you start to think then about the long term, that you cannot have a major bull market that has the potential to deliver returns that are outsized in nature for decades at a time without there being a really good fundamental case. And in this case, the really good fundamental case, it can be predicated on three very big themes. One of these is population growth, that we currently have a population of about 6.5 or 7 billion, that we're going to go up to about 9 billion in the next 20 years. And that could potentially be a disaster, but it's unlikely to be, because we're seeing that the trend of governance is improving, and improving in some of the world's biggest population centers. It's really big news that we're getting people reaching their productive capacity, and that there are going to be an additional 2 billion consumers in the next 20 years. Well, not only are you going to have 2 billion consumers, you're going to have an additional 2 billion workers. That alone would be enough to support a major bull market. That previously, when you've had secular bull markets, it's been concentrated in one region or another, and this is truly global. Well, it's not only that. It's that we have technological innovation is accelerating. That's helping the productivity of advanced economies. But what we also have is not only is technology and technological innovation accelerating, but that availability of that technology is global now. That previously, access to technology was limited to a small number of economies, and now access to technology is global. So that not only do you have governance improving and more people reaching their productive capacity, but that their productive capacity is also improving as a result of access to technology. And again, that is another major constituent of the bull hypothesis. And the additional one is that energy prices are trending lower. Well, throughout human history, that energy has been an extractive sector. Well, that's unlikely to be the case over the next few years. That whereas previously we've relied on
digging coal out of the ground, cutting down trees, or biomass, that or drilling oil wells, drilling natural gas. That what we're now moving into is a technology-driven bull market. That the potential for solar to displace not only energy production capacity, but transport capacity is becoming a, I would say, progressively more accepted as the base case scenario. Over the last decade, we have been calling loudly and frequently the fact that unconventional oil and gas was a game changer for the energy sector, and that is now largely in the price. That the Baker Hughes rig count has fallen from approximately 1,600 rigs to 660 rigs since December. The pace of the decline has moderated, but it hasn't ticked up just yet. Well, what we've also seen is that in line with that cut in the rig count, that the price of oil has collapsed. We've seen the price of oil bounce over the last 2 months, and it was stronger in here today by an additional couple of percent. That WTI is back above 60, Brent crude is back above 65. Those are 4% moves on the day. Pretty impressive upward dynamics here. It suggests that this is still a process of consolidation in the region of the 200-day moving average. It's been a bit more volatile than one might have expected. And what we can say is that this is still a process of consolidation following the very large pullback. That oil prices haven't yet hit their peak, but that we can look at the rig count and say that the pace of the decline is moderated, and that as the higher prices go, the more likely that the more expensive unconventional supply is to return to the market. It puts a logical cap on the extent to which oil prices can rally. That alone would contribute to a ranging environment, at least until demand picks up enough to overwhelm the supply from unconventional sources. And so far, the unconventional oil and gas boom has really only been within North America. That we haven't yet had the globalization of that technology. The higher price, if prices were likely to go higher, then the internationalization of that technology would accelerate. It means really that the bull market in energy prices is over, but that it's not just, that's only part of the story, that solar cells are getting progressively more efficient and cheaper, that technological innovation is such that with the application and increasingly dynamic manufacturing methods for carbon nanotubes and, well, nanotechnology lattices in order to boost the efficiency of these cells, that we're going to have phenomenally efficient solar cells in the next 5 to 10 years. It's going to dramatically change the outlook, that we're going to have distributed supply, that every house is going to become its own mini power plant, that with the advent of batteries on a domestic scale, and indeed on an industrial scale, that we're going to have distributed supply. It means that with China now really starting to tackle its emissions problem, its pollution problem, particularly in the Northeast, that they're starting to say or mandate that they want a lot more electric vehicles on the roads. Since that's the largest car market, that we're probably going to have a lot more electric cars on our roads everywhere else too. Well, if you have a domestic battery and you have an electric car and you have the ability for solar cells to be so much more efficient, well, the potential then for solar to be totally disruptive on the oil market is increasingly important. Well, then if you start to tie all of these things together, that we've lived through a period of time where energy prices were incredibly high, and that altered behavior, not least because it increased the cost of doing just about everything. Well, you reduce the cost of energy, you increase the supply of technological innovation, and you have good governance. Well, you start adding all of those things together and you start to generate real value in company earnings. Well, in the medium term, I guess in the short term, we've had a loss of momentum and we're still ranging. Over the medium term, we've been trending higher for 6 years. And that eventually we're going to get into a choppier period of consolidation. But that over the long term, that there is the potential that this is really only the foothills of what is potentially another 20-year bull market. And in that case, the buying opportunity that would be represented by any real mean reversion is really very relevant. The arbiter is going to be what happens with government bond yields. Just about everything is priced off of the 10-year. And government bond yields rising will endanger the funding mechanism that has been one of the real stalwarts of this 6-year bull market. That companies refinancing their debt, taking out new debt, and buying back their shares has been a major contributor to the consistency of the advance that has been evident on the stock market. Well, if we start to see government bond yields rising, and therefore the absolute rate at which companies can borrow money increasing, well, companies don't really have to refinance in 2015. They don't have much to refinance in 2016, but there is $350 billion needs to be refinanced in 2017, 2018, and nearly $400 billion the year after. If you start to look then at where are the problems likely to arise in terms of corporate financing, well, then you're looking a few years out from here. We will always be guided by the price action, and that is really where the basis for where we come up with how we view the wider market. Well, I think with that, I will leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.